Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. On March 31st, we taped a book show before a live audience at the Manchester Elementary Middle School in Manchester, Vermont, for a Northshire bookstore event. A mighty sold-out crowd of more than 700 gathered to hear from MSNBC's Rachel Maddow about her new book, Drift. Maddow has hosted her own radio and TV shows for the better part of the last 10 years, going from local radio in the Pioneer Valley to Air America to MSNBC, where she has hosted The Rachel Maddow Show since 2008. In Drift, she argues that America's national defense has become disconnected from public oversight. On the book show, which will broadcast tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. and Thursday evening at 8:30, we will hear from Maddow about the book. This morning, we hear our conversation that followed, which deals with her career, politics, and writing.
This is what I find fascinating about your story, because I've been in radio for 27 years, something like that.
Really?
Yeah.
Since you were four.
Well, a long time. A long time. And so you go to Stanford, and then you go to Oxford, and then you work in local radio.
Isn't that how everybody does it?
I have never met anyone in local radio. I mean, it's hard to find someone who speaks and stands up straight. And I'm with guys that have cold cans of Chef Boyardee and just eating them out with a spoon.
I love that, actually.
Yes. Well, so at what point did you say, okay, while you were working on your dissertation,
yeah,
and you started...
Are you familiar with the concept of odd jobs?
Yes, yes.
That's what I was doing.
Well, and obviously, many people, to support a career in radio, do odd jobs. But for you, that was one of the odd jobs.
Radio was an odd job.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went to England. I went to grad school in England, and then I ran out of money and scholarship before I was done with my dissertation, because I had a really good time living in England. And I was absolutely, totally flat, dead broke with tens of thousands of dollars of student loan debt. And I really wanted to finish my dissertation because I never wanted to be in academia, so I couldn't like try to get a teaching job and be ABD, like be the person who did everything except the dissertation. I really wanted to finish it so I could justify all that time I spent screwing around in London. And so my plan was, I need to be miserable. So I need to live in a place that's very uncomfortable and where I have no friends, so I can see the only way out of where I am is finishing this damn thing. So I had two options for living a very unhappy life. My father's best friend from the Air Force is a Republican lawyer in Orange County, California.
Okay.
That would work.
Yeah, that'd do it.
He offered me a former broom closet, a windowless office in his law firm basement or something, and I was like, that would work. But then I had friends who I'd known from growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area who had moved to Western Massachusetts because they heard it was Lesbianville, USA. Woo! Which it is. And they opened a B&B, which is a bad idea. you can't ask in Vermont. Anybody here know somebody who runs a B&B? Don't put your hand up. But it's a very difficult form of work. It sounds charming. It's not charming. It's 24 hours of work, constant slavery. So they ran a B&B for a few years, decided that this was a bad form of work, decided to go back to full-time employment outside the home, but they wanted to keep their place, this beautiful place they had bought to run the inn. And so while they're going back to work full time, they said, well, we need somebody to take care of the dogs and do sort of like handyman stuff and like go to the dump and, you know, burn the brush and stuff. And I said, if I don't have to pay rent, I will stay with you and do all of that stuff. For what? It'll take me like 8 weeks. But I figured I'd be miserable because it was in New England where I didn't want to live. It was in the country where I didn't want to live. And there were dogs, which I didn't particularly like. And I thought I'd be bad at everything they assigned me to do. So I figured it would be awful. Perfect. And now here it is 13 years later, and I live in New England in the country with a dog, and I love it here.
Yeah.
So I had way more fun than I intended to, and I ended up overstaying my welcome and having to pay money, you know, get money to eat. And so I worked as I drove deliveries until my car broke down, and I did handyman stuff until I installed the plumbing fixture on the end of a faucet backwards and exploded the faucet. I worked at Indigo Coffee Roasters in Northampton, Massachusetts, and I was doing all of their unskilled labor, including stamping the word decaf on like hundreds of coffee bags, hundreds of them upside down, everyone. I'm just bad at everything, to the point where my last job, I got demoted from everything at Indigo to the point where my job was bucket washing. And that's what I was doing. I was unloading trucks, so unloading bags of raw coffee beans off of trucks and washing buckets. And my friends who I was living with said, you know, we listen while you're sleeping in the morning, not finishing your dissertation, hint, hint, we have been listening to this very funny morning zoo radio show called Dave in the Morning. And the news girl is leaving, so they're doing open auditions. Why don't you do that? And they dared me, and I went to the open audition, and I got hired on the spot, and I started the next day.
At what point do you think on the radio you found your voice of what it is that you wanted to say? Because starting in commercial radio, certainly, and also small market radio, gives you, at least it did for me, you have incredible opportunities, but there's also, you know, a lot of crap that goes along with that as well, but you get to do everything.
Yeah.
So at what point did you say, okay, this is where I'm comfortable thinking and talking and reacting?
That's a very good question. I liked being on the radio immediately, which I think is a form of egotism.
Yes.
You know, you put on microphone, yeah. I mean, we could probably talk about this privately, yeah. But you know, you put on headphones and you hear your own voice come back to you, and that either turns your stomach or you want to do it more. And jerks like us want to do that more. So it's so that happened. There was a sort of instant click for me that, oh, this is fun. And it was being in morning zoo radio. It was all jokes. It was great. Like, I read AP copy in terms of the news, and then Dave and I joked about it. And on Fridays we wrote jingles. You know, it was great. I'm a bad singer, so that hurt that. But you know, I spent exactly 1 year, 365 days on the radio after getting that gig. And then I had to go back to England to finish my dissertation. And, you know, I have to do like an oral exam to defend your doctorate. And I did that. And that was just a couple of weeks, I think, maybe even less. A couple of weeks? Yeah, end of August of 2001. And so as soon as I came back, figuring out what I'm going to do in my life, 9/11 happened. And when 9/11 happened, I mean, you probably remember, even all the local commercial radio around the country, including here, everybody broke format, you know, like people stopped voice tracking and started putting real people on the radio, and there were call-ins, and we were all turning up at the VA Medical Center to donate blood, and there were drives of all different kinds, and there were community meetings, and there was vigils, and it was an emotional time. And radio was part of that. Radio became more local than it had been. And I realized that I wanted to feel helpful. And one of the ways that I wanted to feel helpful was that I wanted to help out in being informational on the radio. And so I called WRSI, The River, in Northampton, and just said, hey, you know, I used to be on the WRNX morning show. Could I pick up spare shifts? Like, is there anybody who needs fill-ins? Like, I'd be happy to do weekends or weird times. I know you're staying live overnight. I'll take late night shifts. I'd like to just help out. And that's, I think, where I realized that the radio was more than just an odd job, that it was something that I wanted to, it was a way to connect with people. And that eventually turned into me hosting the morning show on the River. And then when Air America was founded, I forced them to hire me. I did. I like crammed my foot in the door, and they were trying to shut it, and I can't hear my ear. Yeah.
And you were on the air with Air America, and then you got the gig with MSNBC, mm-hmm. and did both for a little while, and then Air America went off the air. Can a liberal network survive? Can something like that happen? Were there problems inherent within Air America, or is an audience issue?
It's a good question. I don't know. And it'll be interesting to see if anybody ever tries to start a liberal radio network again. I mean, certainly there are individual liberal radio hosts who have done very well. And a lot of them have crossover on TV, people like Ed Schultz and Stephanie Miller and Bill Press and Tom Hartman and guys like that. So there's definitely people who have figured out a way to reach a large audience and stay on the air. Maybe the problem was that we were trying to launch a network, which is by definition a large overhead thing. That you're asking people to make a big commitment to. You're trying to turn over a whole radio station to an untested format with unproven hosts who, you know, you have to train every liberal in America that there's an AM part of the radio. I mean, before Air America, like, occasionally there's somebody here and there, but it's sports, religion, and people telling you that the president's a Muslim. I mean, that's sort of it. So it's trying to, like, take over a medium that had no liberals in it was a big reach. And so maybe that was the right way to do it, you know, sort of go big and try to do it that way. But it didn't work as a network. I am still super grateful to Air America. There's no way I would be here today without the experiment that was Air America. They hired me because I forced them to. I mean, I was an unrated morning show host in a tertiary, unranked Western New England market, playing 9-minute Miles Davis songs and running up to stand on the median in the middle of Main Street in Northampton and give away tickets, and then running back downstairs before the song was over to play the local furniture store ad. I mean, it was really, and they're like, yeah, okay, now move to New York. So it's crazy that they hired me, but they hired me, they gave me a chance, I ended up with my own show. That's the only reason that I ended up on TV. And I told Air America from the beginning, because we were on the rocks before we were out of the cove, that I would be the last one, that I would stick it out, that no matter what happened, as long as they would have me, I would stay there. And it's true, I told them, you know, I'll be the last plane off the island, and I was the last plane off the island, and stuff was on fire by the time I was taking off. But I'm very grateful for it, and I hope I am really happy about the success of liberals who have stayed in the radio market, and I hope that that will expand. But it's a tough medium.
Because it would seem to me, in some cases, if you were to be on the radio, you can even get a larger audience than you have on television. Now, while you do not win in the ratings to
Fox beats everybody.
Well, Fox beats everybody in TV news, but ultimately, like, Cartoon Network still beats Fox,
oh,
right?
Yeah. Everybody watching cable news all at once, if you combined everybody over the course of 24 hours, Deadliest Catch beats us. Easy. So, like, we get all excited about, like, oh, I got 3% more than you in the demo on a Tuesday. Yeah, you know what? Talk to SpongeBob. Because, we're not that big a deal. Yeah.
Right.
So, and radio has a big audience. It's true.
Yeah. So you could do that if...
I could do that if I, you know, had a second Rachel who I sent off to do that. I'm a very slow worker.
Now you like television and you're used to it.
I can only do one thing. I can't do the book and the TV show. I can't do this again. this aged me a decade trying to do this. And, for a while I was doing radio and TV, but both suffered. There are some people who are verbally prolific, and it takes me too long. It takes me 12 hours. I have a 12-hour day every day for doing the TV show. And so that's fine if you do a 12-hour day every once in a while, but that means I'm doing 12 hours a day, 5 days a week, 51 weeks a year. Now for going, you know, in my fourth year of doing this, and to add something to that on a daily basis, I mean, I could do it, but it would be stupid, and I'm not interested in doing anything stupid, I guess.
We want to wrap up, and obviously a lot of folks here want to meet you and get their book signed. We have a couple of audience questions that came in online.
Oh.
This is always the most fun part. We always love this.
Okay.
That's actually why these segments usually are. You never know, right? So, but I like this question. Do you write all the material on your MSNBC, The Rachel Maddow Show?
Yeah. I mean, I work with producers. Here's sort of how it goes. This is a little bit boring, so I'll say it fast. So I go to work, and most of my production staff is already at work by the time I'm there. They, like, work shifts, so they start earlier and work later, but it's not all the same people, you know what I mean? So I get in, I read for a couple of hours. There's already been a meeting before we talk, in which the producers have guessed what they think I might want to talk about, and they write it on the whiteboard that's out in our cubicle farm. And so I read for a couple of hours, and then it's supposed to be 1:30, but it's always 2 o'clock. I run out to the cubicle farm, and I say, right, here's what I want to do. And I erase everything they've got on the whiteboard, and I write down my list. And there's usually, you know, it's usually about 50% overlap. And the list is, here's what the universe of news is today. And based on this universe of news, what can we make the best TV out of? And so we pick six segments, and each of those segments gets assigned to a segment producer, or two or three, depending on what the segment is. And then we assign people to go find guests to talk to about those segments. This is not the way that other shows do this. Other people book people days in advance. That would be so awesome. I can never do that. We make a decision based on that, and then I go in back into my office, and it's like the lights go off, and I become this cave person, and like I pull the blinds down, and it's all like very unpleasant, Matto, don't talk to me, don't knock, not nice, friendly time. And I'm reading. I'm doing research, my own research for those segments. And then one at a time, as I'm doing that, the segment producer assigned to each segment is reporting, fact-checking, putting together tape, putting together elements, making sure that we've got the guests that we want to get, and spending a lot of time on the phone and in the archives amassing what we've got to say about that. And then we work it out. Me and that producer work it out. Usually what happens is that I either type or dictate, and they write it down. Everybody uses recorders so that they can, it's just really embarrassing, so they can record what I'm saying, and they type it up. We match it with the material. They will give me a draft based on what I said, which I then edit. And it's nuts. It's a nuts process. We are just, these brilliant, smart, ambitious producers who would have like 30-year careers in any other business. I'm like chewing them up and spitting them out within 2 years. Like I'm really ruining people's lives. It's way too hard. And that.
Congratulations.
Thank
on
you.
That, by
yeah,
the way.
It feels great. And then at 8:45 p.m. every night, like, oh my God, it's 8:45. What? And then I sprint to the makeup room, and the show's only 90% done, and then I'm banging out edits in the commercials for the F block. Oh, my God. And then at 10 o'clock, is it over? Like, it's just, it's totally unsustainable. So, yes, I write the show.
Is the air your calm place?
No.
I mean,
because even on the days when the show is 100% written and edited before we go on the show, A, there's always the possibility of breaking news. And B, I am unsettled that I re-edit stuff in the moment. So I'm constantly working and reworking the show right up until the last minute that the show is on. And
because you're too cool for school when you're on the air, man.
Really?
Yeah.
You can't see the frantic?
No.
My personal life is my calm place. And so I'm very protective of the time that I have with Susan and the time that I have in Western Mass. Like, when I come home on the weekends, like I'm not doing my normal come home on the weekends thing while I'm doing this book tour, when maybe it'll make me crazy. Because being able to come home, being able to have a couple of days of peace with Susan and our friends, and to go fishing and to walk the dog and to dig in the dirt and do all that stuff, that's when I calm down. But I'm not calm between Monday at noon and Friday at midnight. There's no calm.
Let's end with this one, which I think is a good question about, it's a political question. Would you encourage progressives to work within, say, the Working Families Party in order to increase pressure on Democratic candidates who run on that line, including President Obama, to give more weight to a progressive as opposed to a neoliberal agenda?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's no mirror image on the left and the right. There isn't any equivalent to the conservative movement that sort of drags the Republican Party behind it on the right. On the left, there definitely are progressive movements of all different kinds, but they do not exert the kind of influence over Democratic politics the way the conservative movement does. The Republican Party is sort of like a little dented, rusted, broken axle wagon that gets dragged behind this really impressive machine that is the conservative movement. And on the left, it's much more integrated. It's just sort of one more thing. And so I don't know if the left should try to emulate the right so that maybe the same kind of mirror effect could happen. I think that the way the right works has successfully dragged Republican politics further and further and further to the right in almost an increasingly fast way, so that anything triangulated between left and right keeps moving the center further in their direction. Should the progressive movement try to move Democratic politics to the left? I think it would be interesting if it worked. I don't know if it would work, but the most direct way there is to primary candidates, is to the primary process. I mean, the right knows this, I think, as well as the left. But the if you can conceivably win the general election having primaried the establishment candidate on the left, then you are going to move the politics of that constituency. You're going to move the politics of that part of the world to the left. You do have to be able to win the general election, though, because if all you succeed at is toppling the viable Democratic candidate, and so then the race goes to the Republican, well, congratulations. Go bask in your purity. But if you can topple the establishment candidate and then win, then you've changed the world.
It has been such a thrill to have you on the show. It really has been an absolute delight.
Oh, thank you.
I can't tell you how much I enjoy your work.
Thank you. I am a long time listener, first time caller.
Well,
I have been a fan
you.
Of yours for a very long time, and AMC is absolutely central to who I am. So,
thank you very much.
Rachel Maddow speaking at the Manchester Elementary Middle School on March 31st. The Book Show, which is our interview about her new book, Drift, published by Crown, airs tomorrow afternoon at 3 and Thursday evenings at 8:30 and will be online at wamc.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.